of her precious beach gloves. He once found a rare orange, and Johanna went berserk. Now she wears the orange piece embedded in melted silver on a chain around her neck. She says it's the most priceless jewel in the world, and bonus from my beloved King Philip. Philip is not as rich as a king, but he's richer than a king in two key ways. He holds Johanna's love and deserves it. When Johanna was 18 and he got her pregnant with Mop, not a person had a concern, not even I. Johanna has always been living her destiny. Mop loves her father, yes, but surely not as much as Johanna. And I suspect, or rather hope, not as much as me. Love is not exclusive. Love cannot be weighed. It is not a competition. No one is entitled. Stop this. Stop this slide. You know you won't crawl out this time. Stop. I never found anyone like Johanna found, just right. David, my boyfriend of 15 years, and the source of 2 miscarriages. He was never right, even though he was my childhood sweetheart, just like Mop and Manny. But was David really a childhood sweetheart? Or did my mother force his pedigree on me 1 year after Daddy died as an acceptable cure? Fucking stop your bullshit. Just keep everyone safe now and stop thinking. Stop your fucking thinking. Don't think about miscarriages now. Don't let the delusions, the blackouts back in. And now Kent Drainel, my married surgeon, my love, is all wrong. If not for Johanna and my niece Mop, I'd have nothing, no one. Daddy, oh, Daddy, I'm so sorry, is long gone. Mother died of cancer 2 years ago. A blend of cotton and linen makes up the ceiling-to-floor drapes in this cottage. A rippling white set on each of the 4 windows. They hang from thick silver rods and frame the custom-fit gold blinds which kiss the edges of the inner window frame. The gold blinds can be finger-pushed up from the bottom or down from the top, the dual action on expensive strings, because I never skimp on gifts for Johanna. When I presented the cottage to her, literally cutting a fat pink ribbon around the door, the white drapes were hung on the silver rods with the gold blinds behind. The drapes were curated to perfection with 5 wave folds per panel, and the decorator had pushed each of the 4 blinds 12 inches from the top and 8 from the bottom, all 4 windows identical. As soon as Johanna entered, she jumped behind one of the white panels and prodded me to jump behind my own so we could compete on who made the best ghost curtain. She won, but I put up some stiff competition. I can never tell who's the judge in these games we've played our whole lives. I think we ate a whole half of a chocolate cake after that first ghost curtain game in the cottage. A stain remains of one of Johanna's chocolate fingerprints on one of these panels, because she wouldn't stop touching everything and gushing over every single detail of her surprise. I can't find the panel with her chocolate fingerprint right now. The light in here is full of tricks, blinding me to all benevolence and showing only shadows and evil. My ears, too, they betray me. They detect only footsteps and banging, although I never find any verified source after racing to each window. Tonight, as I pace once again, I finger a white curtain and note how the panels no longer match in wave folds. One has no folds, stretched tight to the middle, his mate panel scrunched into 100 folds on the end of its side of the rod. Like a cowering teen wincing from a grown man unbelting his pants. I'm so sorry, Daddy. I should have gone shopping with Mother and Johanna. I'm sorry I let him drag me by my hair to the coach house, to tear away my clothes, to shove his metal pin in my mouth. I was 14. I'm so sorry I couldn't stop him myself. Oh, stop. Stop thinking. Stop remembering. Focus on the curtains. Survey what's in this room. Think about simple things. Get through this night. The windows are rattling in the wind. Look at the glass. Another window's panels scrunch to opposite ends of their rod, like a long-married couple in a king-size bed. Another window holds newlywed couples, both scrunched together, huddling in the middle of their silver rod. Like Kent and I hold each other at the Kistop Hotel. At my window, I use both panels to pretend I'm a curtain ghost, sending soundless boos to my sleeping sister, hoping I'm making her laugh in her dreams. It's 3:30 a.m. I'm losing my mind. Call the cops. I can't call the cops. I'm going to the hospital in the afternoon, looking for Kent and figuring this out like a trained clinician. I note I'm still in my nurse's outfit from my shift. I won't change before my next shift. The thought of being an inch from Johanna is unthinkable. I jostle my hospital ID clipped to my breast pocket. Thankfully, Mop does not return from college for another couple of days. Maybe I should write a mean note to Kate Drainel like Johanna suggested. I'll have to admit to the affair in my mind in a naked, honest way. Yes, I guess I should purge the virulence on paper. Writing would make me think straighter. I'll rip it up right after. I'll open the cherry-top drawer on the coral dresser and extract a note card and a pen which lie adjacent to Johanna's pack of smokes. I begin my note to Kate Drainel. I am the mistress. Know it. Know it. I am the one sleeping in your bed.
Chapter 6. Mop. Present time. Still sitting here in the hole, my legs crossed, the dirt wall an inch from my face. I'm huffing wet clay, the most primal aroma. The woman who hunts us is stomping up and down on the cover above. Paint chips, paint chips, paint chips, and splinters rain into our hair. I'm nearly there, nearly to a point where my breath is calibrated to some semblance of a determined plan. Almost to a point where I won't throw up if I move. Thinking and calculating on a way to wake my companion and haul on out. Why didn't I run away when I found the woman in Auntie's barn? Maybe my car didn't break down so suddenly 2 weeks ago. Maybe I was also being intentional when my car broke down where it broke down. Maybe I missed Manny in a sudden rush. A sudden light after 2 years of hiding, of denying. He still lives at the end of a twisted path from Auntie's house, across Paddock Point's sea-lapped granite front face, and after a sometimes treacherous beach. But does he still live there? Is he still alive after what's happened? I can't tell from down here in this hole in the earth. As I look back over the last 2 weeks, when I first approached Auntie's, I was excited to be emerging from the fog I waded in. To even have anger at her for her abandonment. To have longing for love once again felt invigorating, new. Like awakening from a long sleep in which you remember no dreams. Over the last 2 weeks, truths blew up in my face, forcing me to acknowledge them, all the life I blocked. And truths I ignored for 2 years. One being the boy I love. Manuel Acista, an old-school Spanish name. We kissed all the time, at first innocently. He's lean and dark and holds a foreign mysteriousness to those who don't know him, even though he's pure American. He carries a remarkable brown birthmark under his right eye. I'd spent incalculable summer weeks, fall weekends, winter weekends, spring weekends with Manny, in his domain, Auntie's domain, or between those two domains. Over the past 2 years, I thought I got only a few texts from him, my love. How strange, given the height our relationship did reach, all the way up to the night of the fire. Long ago, Manny helped break the case on which creatures kept stealing Auntie's roses. Spoiler, not the bunny I'd chased into a butterfly bush, and not the mermaid-obsessed seagull named Frank that Manny dreamed up. The thefts kept up another summer after our 13th, so it was in our 14th year when Manny cracked the case. One day, late in our 14th summer, we saw a fox slinking along the edges of Auntie's lawn, 3 rose petals stuck to his fur. Pushing through brambles and past bushes and berries, Manny found the fox's literal bed of roses, a matted pad on the floor of the forest, pink and red and yellow petals mixed with strands of his shedding fur. I spent the next week writing a script for a play as a way to expose the fox, whom we named Mr. Gilray, to Auntie and her invited barn party neighbors. Manny illustrated the set with Auntie's acrylics, and she didn't care. I played Mr. Gilray, the fox. Manny played himself, finding the bed of roses. Auntie clapped and hoo-hooted and whistled, leading the longest standing ovation when we drew the final curtain and dumped 2 buckets of tissue paper rose petals, red, pink, and yellow rain, the particles of which still stick to props in the prop box. She'd promised to take pictures so I could show my mother, but I recall her only clapping and clapping and clapping with 2 free hands. No camera. So when Auntie drove me home, only 45 minutes to Rye at the end of that summer week, we sat by the Rye pool and regaled my mother with every single detail, but no pictures. My mother giggled and laughed and petted my head and asked a million questions for even more details and reenactments, saying she would have come if she'd known. And as I look back on this memory, it did seem like Auntie sat with a condescending smirk as I retold my mother about the play, as if Auntie presented me and this story as a passive-aggressive consolation prize to my mother, her sister, like I was a toy between them? No. No, that is just me overlaying our present circumstances on the past, recoloring things in a negative light. No. At 17, Manny pitched a tent in his backyard facing the sea and suggested I sneak from Auntie's after she snored herself into the whispers of waves. I ran to him with a flashlight in my teeth. Hiking over the dangerous middle beach, I thanked goodness for delivering a cycle of low tide. Once settled in his yellow tent, he lifted my summer dress and showed me what it means to be with one another. Our sweet rocking movements matched the rhythm of the sea below the cliffs. We continued all summer like this, with a pregnancy scare in July. Just a scare, no pregnancy. Which fear I discussed in a bed cuddle with my mother one night in Rye. That night, she kept rubbing my head and calling me love bug or smarty tarty or sugar cheeks, mopsy, mop bop, and a couple of her other 1,000,000 names for me. Now I'm just Mop, the recent college grad. After that 17th summer and the pregnancy scare, Manny and I jetted off to our respective objectives, me traveling, him in his freshman year in London, quite tanned and satisfied. Minus the pregnancy scare, we repeated our summers like this for several years, me adding Princeton in the mix. When our 23rd summer came, I thought Manny and I would continue on, but in a more significant, permanent way, for we'd grown up some and went the opposite way of typical childhood romances. We got closer. In the school year prior, we maintained a constant, as in daily, stream of letters, racked up long-distance bills with nearly everyday phone calls, and in between, sent emails and texts and IMs. But our 23rd summer came 2 years ago. The fire happened, and Auntie barred my return. My life thereafter a blur. Is Manny still alive? I listen to the thunder claps above us now. Lightning cracks the sky, illuminating electrical air to beam through the cracks of the wooden cover. The woman with the hatchet is pacing like a panther, unable to find where we entered. She stops roaming, stalling just above our heads. I can see up through the slivers of space between planks of wood to her ball gown, the ripped lining and the dragging remnants of the skirt's tulle lifted in updrafts of high wind that accompany the lightning. I cringe upon an explosion in the sky, another thunderhead howling like a million wolves. She crouches and starts hacking away at the wood with her bloody hatchet. Splinters and paint chips fall more on our cowering heads. I pull myself up, and next my companion, whom I shook awake a minute ago, to push us to the secret entrance point on the opposite end of this dirt basement. We're going to have to haul out upon the song of the next thunder wolves and hope nature's furious voice masks our footfall. This is an impossible situation. I'm relying on lightning and thunder to save us. The woman with the hatchet didn't hear us move under her feet. She's still hacking away in the middle of the wooden cover. "Bitch!" she yells again and again. It's the only word she speaks. Nature is the sorceress of physics. So she forms an early hurricane in the dead of summer, for fun or judgment or both. As we emerge topside, loud crashing waves collide with loud smashing heavens, and literal green veins of lightning rip the sky as if to etch Earth's ceiling forever, like a witch's furious face cracking a mirror. All this commotion is a cover for me and my companion as we climb up and out, setting our bloodied feet in holes I'd carved in the dirt wall 2 weeks ago so as to create a natural ladder. Because this is where I ran when I found the woman in Auntie's barn. 2 weeks ago, I arrived and stood in Auntie's side room potting shed, which, as far as I knew 2 years ago, was storage for her medical equipment. Some nonsense some family of a home patient gave her. I burst in the side room and found a woman asleep or unconscious, but not dead. A monitor noted her heart rhythm, and I heard the wheeze of her breath. At the time, my mind couldn't keep and hold any of the fragments of multiple questions popping in my brain like poured carbonation. A hospital room in a barn with a patient? A patient? The woman in the bed looked inhuman to me, with almost undetectable facial features. Her face was so bloated. She didn't budge when I screamed. Her heart monitor, some other monitoring device, and her saline either hummed or dripped away, calm against the chaos I saw. I curled my eyes at Auntie. As in, my pupils twisted near out of their sockets in a total derangement. I couldn't accept the gravity of such a secret. Auntie has a woman in a hospital bed in her barn. She hasn't let us visit for 2 years. Why? What? Auntie stood in the doorway, blocking me, watching with her one good eye and still exposed dead socket. She clocked my moves with her head askance, appearing frightened at seeing me seeing this woman in a bed in her barn, and perhaps frightened, too, upon thinking on what she must do in her mind to keep me quiet. I had never before allowed a feeling of fear of Auntie. I always permitted perceptions of safeness around her, so I didn't understand my own feet when I took 2 steps back and deeper into the medical room, away from her. I braced my hands behind me on a white metal cabinet stocked with gauze and sheets. Auntie appeared a stone-cold psycho, not rising to my alarm and meeting it. She placed a straight finger on her lips, slow, controlled, and said, "Shh," revealing the triangles of her broken teeth. Despite the wicked visual of her shh, the sound was not the annoying slap kind of shh. Rather, it was the coaxing shh one uses to lead a witless cow to a jaded butcher. Black boards blocked the side room's one window. The one that previously looked upon Auntie's herb garden, backyard, and the path to the guest cottage. Rusty nails secured the boards, all cockeyed and rough, into the barn's sheet-rocked wall, and I guess the joists behind. Only the barn's side room was sheet-rocked, painted, and temperature-controlled, while the rest of the barn remained like any drafty pine New England horse barn. Auntie stepped into the side room and stood at the foot of the medical bed. I didn't hesitate. I pushed past her and out into the center barn, back through the fake rear door and down along the path to the burned guest cottage. All the barriers and garrisons and moats I'd erected and dredged to block grief crumbled to nothingness. I wanted my mother so bad in that insane moment. Remembered her huge, long hugs so fierce that my body would shake. My mind sought to take my body to the place of her last sleep, to scour the soot in the basement for any trace of her. I don't recall the blinding run through the brambles. I recall being surprised to find myself in the middle of the mouth that opens upon the cottage's minor yard, as if a blink changed my location. The snaky vines ate the twisted trees and unfurled their pointed tendrils to scratch my triceps on both sides. The day waned into a haze blue evening, so my path was lit, but giving way to dusk shadows. As this was 2 weeks ago, the sky was clear and navy, unlike tonight, which is stormy and gray and full of green lightning, or between lightning, blackened by lightless chaos. 2 weeks ago at dusk, my eyes burned to keep focus in the tricks of light and the tricks of rage. I came to the burned cottage remains, the first time since racing here with my father on the morning after my mother was reported missing off the cliff wall, after the fire. Auntie hadn't tended the path well since then, nor did she groom the grounds around the cottage, so those greedy vines and the brambled vegetation had taken dominion like a mutinous jungle, swallowing evidence that humans once slept here. In the interim, what Auntie did, however, was construct and set atop the now exposed basement a square wooden cap made of sheets of reclaimed plywood, spackled and speckled with layers of old paint, the various sheets braced by crisscrossed 2x4s. I know Auntie never constructs anything without false doors, like the back of her barn, like the pink birdhouse we built for that funny bird long ago, or like the pivot bookshelf that is really a door to a closet where she stores wine. So I noticed in an instant the near invisible hinges on one section of the plywood at the far end. Although she'd never admit it, Auntie has a tendency to view the world in dramatic ways, like me. This is part of our shared identity, something I accept, but I believe she tries to deny. So under a coming full moon and cloudless sky, so unlike tonight, and needing my mother so bad I wanted to die, I knew down to my bones that under that hidden hatch Auntie had built a shrine to my mother. I flipped up the section of plywood at the hinge, and as it banged on solid wood, Auntie crashed onto the scene. "No!" she yelled. "Don't go down there! Don't disturb things! Who is the woman in the barn?" I yelled back as I ignored her walking closer, gaining on me. I looked into the hole. So dark there, stained of soaked soot, charred wood, coal streaks everywhere, and scattered debris from the fire that was never cleaned out. Whatever fell from the cottage to the basement and didn't incinerate was left to rot under Auntie's patchwork cover. This was no shrine. This was a trash pit of my mother's last touched items. One of my mother's favorite animal print Tory Burch flats sat beneath the opening I peered through, and within a beam of the moon's rising ray. If the shoe is here, what about the shoes the investigators say she wore, running to the ocean on fire, Which pair? She usually wore her flats when she stayed at Auntie's. That's what I questioned 2 weeks ago.
What pair of shoes my mother wore to launch herself off a cliff to stop her body from burning?
Why is this shoe down here?
I told myself I was inventing irrelevant nonsense by questioning the shoe's presence and entered the pit to get her shoe. The only thing I had of hers to hug.
I considered the shoe a talisman I could rub to pry my mother away from the selfish grips of her afterlife.
I didn't consider the implausibility of such a wish. I just wanted the shoe. Wanted it more than I wanted Auntie to explain the unexplainable horror in her barn.
2 weeks later now, as I and my companion tremble outside the same basement hole, for we just used the clamor of nature as a cover to escape, I don't understand the total insanity that has overtaken my family. My companion and I shiver in silence, hoping the woman with the hatchet, still hacking at the wooden cover, won't see us. We're in the realm of the unthinkable, the unfixable, the unregulated by any laws, man-made or divine. I wish I and my companion could run. And we try. But more green lightning rips the sky, illuminating the night to a glowing green, veining the heavens, etching time, wrinkling space. I can't hear my own thoughts, given the thunder dump trucks crashing into tractors in the sky. And with that noise collide all the hydrants in the world, which rise in tsunamis, only to kill themselves in screams against the cliff wall. A minute runaway, but beside us tonight. My brain bashes against my skull, trying to escape. We freeze, hoping the hurricane won't distract the hacking woman from her job to see us. Thunder rocks me, pushes me, and I trip. I'm face down in the dirt above the hole, so my feet twist in vines. My face hovers above the open hatch to the basement. The woman with the hatchet still has her back to us as she swings down and cracks through the wood cover.
Bitch!
She yells into a new jagged hole. I'm going to get Auntie Roosevelt's gun, I think.
And as I do, like the woman hears me thinking, she turns and sees me and my companion, who has also fallen to the ground, a belly across my leg with the fabric tie around the calf, so as to stem the flow of blood from my earlier hatchet wound. I should stand and pull my weak companion along, try to edge us out beyond the hatchet woman. But we're trapped. The vegetation is thicker than 2 weeks ago, and we can't bust through the hedges and brambles and pricker bushes surrounding us on all sides. The only way out is the skinny trail the woman cut, back out to the walking path, all of which is behind her and at the opposite end of this burned and covered basement. Thunder cracks a few gray eggs in the sky, and the first trickles of rain sizzle down. The torrent of all the cracked eggs will begin soon. Wind whips in racing cycles around the three of us, the hatchet woman, me, and my companion, tying us in crazy invisible ribbons and holding us to our spots. The ribbons of wind also bring eggshells of rain to fly into my eyes and sting them with their sharpened velocity. I peer down the hole from which we escaped, in which we were hidden, and given the storm clouds thickening more above, I can't see much. Where are my glasses? My contacts? I'm blinded by my natural eyes as well. Fuzzy in daylight even without the blurriness of a hurricane. Upon the next crack of lightning, the space below is lit like 2 weeks ago. Only then illumination was steady, provided by a faithful full moon. I'm immediately transported again to the moment when I saw my mother's Tory Burch shoe in the dirt, and needed only her shoe, coveting it with my withered soul. As if 2 weeks ago were now, I hear Auntie say, as she said in that moment, "Let her go," meaning my mother. I will never let her go. So, Here I am, thinking again. I realize I must be fading into unconsciousness, for I should be focusing on getting me and my companion out of the storm and away from the hatchet. But it's easier to rest, just a second, and go where my mind wants to go.
2 weeks ago, I dug into the soil of the cottage basement, making footholds in the soft earth to reclaim my mother's Tory birch. At the bottom, I captured and clutched it to my chest and ignored Auntie above, until, hearing her scramble on down into the hole to join me, I looked up at her and her mangled face like a rabid beast, like I was the one with the mangled face. How dare she keep this shoe from me for 2 years? I could have held it. I could have cried into it. I could have conjured my mother in a round of Ouija while wearing it. I could have commanded the shoe to return my mother back to land and out of the sea. I thought all these things, and no, I did not consider the impossibility or the implications of the witch's spell I brewed in my mind.
Witch's spell? That's not real.
Who is the woman in the barn, Auntie? I said in a growling, unnatural voice, me now the deranged psychopath, not her.
She puffed out an exhale, closed her working eye.
Who is the woman in the barn?
I clutched my mother's soiled shoe tighter, merging the sole to my sternum. Auntie breathed deep and creased her brow, but still said nothing.
Who is the woman in the barn?
Don't yell, Mop, please. That's so unlike you.
Oh, seriously? Seriously? For real? Who is the woman in the barn, Auntie?
I stressed Auntie as two distinct syllables in an intentional aggression to her face, challenging her identity before me. How dare she tell me what's like and unlike me, suggesting I don't know my own self? Do I know my own self? She sighed, opened her one working eye, strained the lid on her dead one, but low, and inhaled in a long and contemplative intake, perhaps a calculating intake, like even she questioned every word she was about to speak.
She's my friend, she said.
She turned a circle, sticking her thumbnail in her teeth, slipping there when catching nothing but a hole. Her thumb fell farther in her mouth.
Mop, you can't tell anyone about her. I could go to jail.
Mop. Mop, are you listening? Who is the woman in the barn? I said, slow and gritted, the shoe in my hand like a weapon for a bludgeon.
Auntie shook her head and dropped her shoulders, as if in that moment she gave up whatever battle she'd been waging, whatever facade she thought she was keeping.
Her voice cracked. She breathed in quick breaths through her open throat, a minor hyperventilation.
Fine, 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 fine,
she said to the ground, catching herself from falling by placing a hand on the dirt wall. Not looking up to meet my eyes with her one good eye, she said in a hushed mumble,
"Here's the story with the woman in the barn."
She looked up at me, her eye wide and glowing green like an alive crystal ball. I didn't recognize her still.
"Mop, I hope to God you understand how serious this is and you'll not say a word. I didn't want to involve any of you in any of this."
"God? You hope to God?" I asked. How dare she invoke God in the basement where my mother last slept? We were on the most sacrilegious soil anywhere ever in the history of forever. We were in the epicenter of hell, and here she had the authority to say the word God?
God who? God where? Where is my mother, God? I want my mother back, God. Oh, Mop, there you are.
Auntie said in a desperation, like she parted curtains between foggy dimensions, having scoured every multiverse in search of me. As if for the past 2 years I didn't live an easy 45 minutes away in Rye, or a click or dial away at Princeton. Some spell broke around her. Her face once again the face I knew, albeit scarred and toothless and missing an eye and sad, but warm and full of light. I could read the transformation and all the emotions she conveyed in a simple second. For I spent countless hours with her my whole life. I knew her best. As much as I knew my mother, more than anyone else on this planet, save Manny. We read the ones we love like the sightless master blindness, eons with the Braille. And she was my Braille. And if I'm being truthful, I'd read her scary Braille before. One night, when I was 15, I slept at Auntie's in my own designated room. She woke me when I heard her roaming the halls, talking to herself in a sleepwalk. Moaning like a ghost, she stood in my doorway. Her white nightgown swished around her stick-straight legs from a sea wind blowing through my open window. I got up slow and tried redirecting her back to bed. It had been 3 years since her second miscarriage. Also, when she famously threw David, her longtime boyfriend, to the brambles and out of her life forever. Swaying in my bedroom doorway, my bedroom in her house, Auntie alighted her green orb eyes to me and didn't blink. But I knew she wasn't seeing me. I knew, although I don't think I'd registered one before from her, she was in one of the catatonic states I'd heard the Rye servants whisper about. She said, in a strange stumbling staccato, long pauses and a warbling dropped monotone of slurring, like she'd just had a root canal, "Up's the daughter I should have, David. Daughter should mine, David. Why? Can't you give me my own daughter? David, 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 you fail." She picked up the pace of her warbling, dropped monotone, as if she'd been shot with adrenaline, although she kept her bright eyes, which seemed filmed over, unblinking. Why was I the one to lose the babies? Why was I the one with the metal in her mouth? Why was I the one with Daddy to die, Johanna? Why, Princess? When she said, "Why, Princess," the phrase was full of hate. Spit seethed in a spray from her mouth. I knew, in reading the Braille of Auntie, what she needed was a soft voice and a sterile reminder of reality, and certainly not fear, and definitely not pity. As I look back from my current age of 25, here above this horror hole, I have to now recognize how strange it was for 15-year-old me to not shy in fright nor be surprised by Auntie sleepwalking and saying, "Why, Princess," like a psychopath. I must now force myself to accept the definition I must have always known I should have always had for Auntie Liv, one far removed from perfection. Did I allow her mental sickness to grow? I fear I enabled her. It was easy to enable this bout of psychosis from her, easy to hide, to bury, and focus on her shininess, because she was not all good and not all bad. She was not one thing, not one dimension. I could choose the safe parts of her if I wanted, and I could do the same for myself if I ever had to. These are the subconscious lessons I must now admit to myself. Back then, during Auntie's haunting night terror when I was 15, I knew that all that would break her night psychosis was a clinical diagnosis and a firm action plan. This is how I liked her treating me when I slipped on ice and yelped in pain after spraining my ankle, or raged in anger at a nest of red ants that caused my shin to swell in a rash, or cried misery tears from missing Manny when he left one August for a month-long soccer camp. So that's what I knew she needed, too. clinical reality and a plan. Either that or my mother's smothering sugar plum-scented hugs, which I didn't have the perfume or breasts or authenticity to pull off. Auntie, it's Friday night at Haddock Point. You are sleepwalking and having a night terror. I will walk you back to bed now. She dropped her hypnotic gaze, closed her eyes, and shook her head. Oh, my. What? Where am I? Mop? She stumbled in the hall, her white nightgown billowing on the hardwood floor as her knees failed. I held her up. Come on, Auntie. It's okay. I'll walk you back to bed. We never discussed the event in the morning, or ever. I didn't even mention the event to my mother, for Auntie's overflowing subconscious thoughts revealed a buried hatred for my mother, one covered and covered in layers of Auntie's fight to sustain a real love. I focused on the layers of love. Perhaps I was wrong to bury such an event. I know now I was wrong to bury such an event. Now, at age 25, 2 weeks ago in the burned basement hole, and again witnessing before me yet another breaking of one of Auntie's psychotic spells, this one with severe implications, all of Auntie's own walls and barriers protecting her from the reality of grief crumbled away, like mine. I saw it happen. It ended up being a short window, though. Mop, oh baby, I'm so sorry, baby. You have no idea how much I miss you. Auntie started to cry. Her shoulders lowered. She sank to the ground, her knees in soft dirt. I wanted to hold her. Her to hold me. I missed her so much, my arms stretched out for her, listening only to my heart and not my fogged frontal lobe, which separated me from my own self with a million questions and red flashing warnings. I had no idea how to understand the woman she kept in the barn. And there I was, holding my mother's soiled shoe in an abandoned basement with a makeshift roof, the scent of wet soil on a full moon summer night. I stood confused within a pit of charred objects. Auntie, you're scaring me. I don't know what you're doing. Who is that woman in the barn? A friend? Why would you... What are you doing? Why do you lock the front doors and bar the back? My heart choked my lungs. I wanted to vomit. Tears came out my eyes, out my nose. My arms wavered in the air. I didn't know what to do with my own hands except grip the life out of my mother's shoe. Oh, baby. Don't worry. Baby, listen. She clawed the dirt walls as a brace to stand again, widened her nostrils to intake air, and steadied herself to continue her story. Still, she did not meet my eyes. Instead, she looked out beyond my shoulder to another dirt wall, staring straight as if she still had two eyes. She's a nurse at St. Jerome's, a friend of mine. She came here 2 years ago, afraid for her life. I stood straighter. 2 years ago? When Mom died? When Mom died! My voice rose with each sentence. Is the woman in the barn connected to what happened to my mother? Auntie's head vibrated rather than shook, like I'd slapped her from her story into present-day reality and the two didn't match. Her head shaking seemed an effort to calibrate facts. No, she said, controlled, in a bellow, like when she'd said, shh, in the side room in her barn. Then came another head oscillation of calibration, and she was back to having an etched forehead of sadness and open grief, staring out beyond my shoulder, reciting her story. No, baby. This was after your mother. After the fire. My friend was having an affair with a married man. And the wife of this married man wanted to kill my friend.
Yes.
So my friend was staying here with me and hiding out.
And
so one night the wife came here looking for my friend.
Auntie turned two more circles, raising her voice and also the rhythm of her narrative, while bouncing faster the double pendants she still wore around her neck. Auntie continued.
This wife, she slammed my friend's head into the foyer floor in the house. My friend went into a coma. The wife fled. I couldn't bring myself to bring my friend to the hospital because...
Auntie cast her eye to my mother's shoe.
Because I didn't know who this wife was, and I couldn't name her, so she got away scot-free. I didn't trust the wife would attack my friend in the hospital, so I kept my friend here. I had all the equipment, and I am a nurse, so I kept her here. And that's all. I kept her here. Before I knew it, a year went by, then two, and I'm in too deep. I don't know how it got so far.
She seemed to think of something else and rushed out some final explanations.
She has no one in the world to care for her. She's an only child, parents dead, no friends. I was her only friend. The hospital and the cops think she ran off and committed suicide. That's a big statistic, you know. People disappearing to a secret place to kill themselves. This last part, the piece about suicide statistics and medical facts, this was a glimpse of the old auntie. But as she related in the course of her crazy story and the false version of herself before me, the statement didn't fit. I squished my eyes, confused, held up a hand to stop her from continuing with her nonsensical words, which I could not accept. I'm not a flaming moron. I flagged the gaping holes in her tale. I logged her shifting eye, her stumbling stutters, her word fillers and repetitions, but 2 weeks ago, I curled into my mother's shoe and sobbed. And also, no matter what Auntie had to say, I still loved her. And it's true, I wanted to protect her, enable her to get well again. Oh God, please stop talking and just hold me, I thought. Please say you love me because I love you.
Holding back tears and wishing for love took all the strength I had left for the day.
Can we go inside, please?
I said with a trembling voice. She jostled at the question, a look of terror on her face.
Inside, she said, as if her own home haunted her. What the fuck is inside? Please.
She did her head shake of calibration once more and returned to a cool, practiced calmness. Of course. Yes, of course, she said. Let's do that. Go inside.
Chapter 7. Mop. 2 weeks ago. Auntie led me out of the burned basement. The night, not raining nor storming. A regular summer night with a full moon. As we neared the side room of the barn in which the woman slept, I stared at the boarded window blocking my view of her. Auntie walked on ahead of me, brushing up the scent of rosemary and basil as she passed her herb garden. A couple of crickets sawed their legs in a solemn violin duet. Auntie's various perennial beds spread out across and around her lawns like a multicolor patchwork quilt. Yellows, purples, pinks, and blues, lit by the big bright moon on high, by strategic solar lights down low, and midair by twinkle lights strung like always throughout the limbs of her willows and birch, maple, and oak. Auntie's roses were in full bloom, and pink, yellow, and red. The pillows of her white hydrangeas were baby clouds, and the blue ones electric sea anemone.
Her annual round forest of 50 sunflowers was growing to its usual monumental height, and about ready to burst into yellow and brown dinner plates atop swaying 10-foot stalks. She always planted the sunflowers in a spiral, and it seemed to me they were a council of elders convening a summit on how to govern Auntie's lawns, and farther, the sea beyond. Guarding the entrance to the sunflower summit, a resident rabbit of gray and white froze like a stone next to his best friend, a granite cherub. Assessing me as a nonviolent threat, the rabbit unfroze and resumed his nonchalance. A blade of grass hung from his slow chewing mouth like a mechanic with a toothpick. The fattest, laziest sentry on the planet. Given this intoxicating environment, I allowed a wave of nostalgia to comfort me for 3 seconds amid the turmoil I felt inside. Nature must have sensed me needing sedation, for she sent a bullfrog to add thrums of bass to the cricket's violins, and a seagull to cut the sky with a cry of soprano, long-winded and mesmerizing. How I used to love this place. My happiness reflected in the concert of the creatures and the rainbows of the plants, and the white noise hum of the strung twinkle lights. I was awakened out of my slip into familiar comfort and back into our new strange reality when, in arriving at Auntie's blue front door, flopping pink hibiscus stabbed a vapor of high-octane sugar up my nostrils, like a magician's finger snapped to the hypnotized. But I wanted the happy hypnosis back. I wanted my mother, my auntie, us, our family. I wanted to conjure illogical, fantastical conversations with that lazy rabbit, and gossip with him in my mind about the snobbish severity of the Sunflower Congress, all tall and high and mighty and pretentious as always, like before. Carefree in my curiosity. I wanted to be better, less frantic in my mind, less grieved, less fogged. I wanted, really wanted, to emerge. I wanted to break down and hug Auntie, and I wanted her to hug me so we could heal each other and at least be us together again. I'd take a fraction of our old lives. Please. Just a splash of happiness back again. Anything, please. Her marble foyer, the mermaid library on the right with the multiple sets of metal mermaid bookends, the living room with the multicolored sea life wallpaper on the left, the one with the blue and white rug I once muddied with potatoes. All the same. The hallway that ran center of the house to the kitchen in the back still held its own pattern of multicolored wallpaper, the hallway's pattern being of birds and vines, not sea life like the living room. It's funny you should show up today with a blown gasket mop. Manny called here today, too, looking for you. He's home from London. Graduated, Auntie said. And another slap to awaken. What did you tell him? Did you tell him where I was? I had just finished crying over my mother and her Tory Burch shoe, which I still held and didn't plan on letting go. What she said about Manny was a wallop of a slap. I stalled in the foyer, the white marble shining like an ice rink after a Zamboni pass. Expecting her to lead me up the stairs to my regular bedroom, I remained waiting for an answer and for her to head up the stairs, but she continued on through the mermaid library. "What did you tell him?" I said louder, causing her to stop by the section of her library she called the good books section. All the good books' spines were cracked so badly you could barely read the titles, for she read or loaned them so often. But unlike 2 years before, dust now covered this frequently used section. It seemed the mermaid bookends were crying, but upon closer inspection, the tears were wispy strings of spent spider webs. Still, Auntie didn't answer me. "Auntie, seriously. Auntie, what did you say to Manny?" Her change of subject to something lighter. Manny, of all things, my lost love, my one lifelong friend, was yet another disconnection to the insanity around us. I sounded frantic over him, and I didn't care. I told him I hadn't talked to you and didn't know where you were. I gave, as I've given him before, your Rye number.
Before? And your Rye number?
She used to always say, the Rye number, as if she could be reached in Rye too. The difference between your and the is meaningful in this context. I felt a stab of pain in my heart, like she abandoned me all over again and meant to stick with it.
He's called several times over the last 2 years, Mop. Hasn't he reached you at the house? At Princeton?
No. Only sometimes. A text message is all, I think. I trailed my words in doubt for some reason I didn't then know or yet acknowledge. With all the strangeness and Auntie flitting in and out of being my old Auntie and this other being of strange psychology, I couldn't even summon anger. How do I explain what fog feels like? Tastes like. Tastes like dehydration. Feels like sitting at the bottom of the pool, brain pulsing, sight wavy, wanting only one thing, air. I followed her to the first floor guest room, the one off the library with gray and green wallpaper and a twin bed, which threw me as yet another sting of abandonment. Won't I stay in my old room? This act of putting me in the gray and green guest room, which is what we always called it, a room she reserved for people who visited her maybe once a year, was so impersonal, like downgrading me to a mere acquaintance. I swallowed air so as not to choke. I fought back tears to be led to this room, a sign I was still and would always be a cast-off. She no longer loved me. No longer wanted me around. She couldn't stand to look at me with her one eye, or worse yet, grew indifferent to my existence. That's how it felt. I wanted to lie down and die. Parading through the mermaid library, I once again questioned the Roosevelt gun in the glass case, and why such violence existed in such an otherwise love-filled room, pointing its barrel out the window at her fantastical lawn. I had my own room in Auntie's house. Upstairs. I stayed at Auntie's so much, both my mother and I did, the family joked how we should claim Auntie's as our permanent address. Obviously, it was Auntie's house. And I would respect if in the 2 years since she shut us out, she'd made renovations. But given the history, wouldn't she explain, acknowledge the change? And at least say why I couldn't use the room she previously, for my entire life, kept solely for me? She'd painted a sign for the door. Mop closet. It's not a closet. It's a girl's room with a canopy bed and lace curtains, a green dresser, a retro record player, a dictionary, a writing desk with all my papers, journals, too, and three of my favorite paintings of the sea painted by none other than Auntie. Oh, baby. And here she was being Auntie again. I'm so sorry. I'm rattled. She hugged me, which felt half true, half false, and too long and too short all at the same time. Pulling away, she said, Right. So, your room. I didn't mention. Right. So there's a raccoon up in the attic. She held her long finger to her closed lips, then popped it off to continue. He's stuck up there. Weird. I had to board the attic doorway and all. I've been trying to get him out of there on my own, but I need to get animal control out here. I'll try tomorrow. He'd keep you up all night with his scratching about. She's been living with a raccoon in the attic? The attic is a finished bedroom with four dormers. It's not really an attic. It's a finished floor of the house with carpeting, a king bed, and a second master's bath. So, and a trapped raccoon? Boarded the attic door? Which attic door? There's two. One from her bedroom and one at the end of the hall in which my bedroom sits. I don't think, yes, I definitely think, I don't believe this story.